Peace be within your walls and security within your towers. For the sake of my relatives and friends, I will say, peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. This ends the reading.
Before I read the second reading, I want to give a little context to what we're doing here. As it is Advent, we are beginning the new church year with a theme from our friends at A Sanctified Art. You might remember, I think it was maybe the beginning of 2017, that Lyle Gwen Garrity came and painted live during worship. It's her group of liturgist, artist, preacher types, and they've given us so much content for this theme of what can't wait. You'll see the theme running through sermons and prayers and song, also front of the bulletin. There are Advent devotionals that you can use for yourself, use at home, and they are under the Christmas tree wreath, or the Christmas wreath, on the back table in the narthex or in the lobby. And if you want to, I can email you, or we can email out one of these Advent calendars. You can just post it on your fridge and move the magnet. Each day has a different practice. I told somebody this morning, I'm really dreading December the 11th. Try not to complain. Wear a hair tie, I guess, or a rubber band, whenever you complain, and switch wrists to help break the habit. Right? That's going to be a tough one. But there are various practices that these folks have given us for Advent, and I commend them to you. And with the theme of what can't wait, the first thing we'll explore today of what can't wait is, of course, hope, this first Sunday of Advent. And this vision for hope comes from the prophet Isaiah. Let us listen for God's wisdom and word. The word that Isaiah, son of Amos, saw concerning Jerusalem and Judah. In the days to come, the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it, and many peoples shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between nations, and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and neither shall they learn war anymore. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Friends, this is holy wisdom, holy word. Have you ever thought about hope as urgent? Perhaps you have, but I think it's safe to say that, at least in practice, hope is more of a passive concept. Think for a moment about how we speak about hope, how we use the word hope in our day-to-day living. You know, I hope it'll work out. I hope she'll stop doing whatever it is she's doing. I hope it won't happen. I hope I make it through this. I hope, and you can insert your preferred outcome here, and then do nothing about it. Hope might be one of those words that we've started to use so much in so many different ways that it's basically bankrupt of any meaningful value. I came across, and don't ask, the internet, you know, is kind of a black hole. So don't ask me how I got this, but there's a tip from a sales coach. Thank God I don't do that anymore. About alternatives for, in your email, hope all is well. Don't raise your hand, but think about it. Are you one of the guilty? Hope all is well. She writes that at least one third of the sales email I get start with a variation on, I hope all is well. And both the recipient and the email writer know it's a nicety thrown in before the real point of the email. And with buyers' attention spans at an all-time low, reps can't afford to waste a single line. To that end, here's our list of alternatives that will make your email less vague, more personal, and hopefully endear yourself to the recipient enough to get a reply. There's 29 of them. I'm not going to read them all, but they've got you covered. Here's three. I hope this email finds you well. I hope you're having an A-plus week. Don't ever write me that. I hope everything's groovy at company name. I mean, it's the banality of it all. Hope is a word that we risk rendering useless. And not only do we speak of hope in passive ways in our ordinary living, but really, even as a theological construct, even as a belief, hope can become a passive thing. I'm thinking of the work of Dr. Miguel de la Torre, who's a theologian and ethicist who wrote a book entitled Embracing Hopelessness. For in the book, he makes a case that hopelessness because, as he believes, it actually motivates ethical action better than hope. Because hope, as a Christian belief, according to Dr. De La Torre, has a way of sedating people to their own oppression and to the role that they play in the oppression of others. I mean, in a cruel and corrupt world, hope functions, he says, to perpetuate injustice more than it motivates resistance to injustice. Now think about that for a moment, hope as a sedative. I mean, that's, to me, a very provocative idea, and I feel convicted by that. Because preaching, and maybe I'm guilty of this, maybe I'm not, preaching that only uplifts a hope in terms of a future rescue, that kind of thinking can do a lot of damage by emphasizing divine action at the expense of human action. You know, the kind of thinking, God's going to sort it all out, just don't worry about it. I mean, that's one extreme. And on the other extreme, there's the alternative, which what I would say would be placing our efforts, our faith in human efforts alone, or in some vague notion of inevitable human progress, which is not much to hope in. All we have to do is look at the last century and the beginning of this one to understand that human progress is much more elusive than we would think. So it is that Isaiah gives us, and the Bible as a whole, I believe, gives us the substance of hope. And the substance of hope, as it proclaims it, is found entirely at the heart of it in the faithfulness of God's action, yet, in a way that includes, that beckons, that draw human beings in and gets a response out of them. You see, hope for Isaiah is actually very urgent. And we know it's urgent because of the audaciousness of his vision, the vision of salvation that he casts for his first hearers. In the days to come, he prophesies, Jerusalem will become this seat of world governance. God's law will become the law. God's ways will become the ways for all the nations, even the Gentiles. God's justice will be delivered to all people. And the end result of all of this is a deep and abiding and everlasting peace. And I say it's audacious for Isaiah to utter these words because these words have inspired people for millennia. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and neither shall they learn war anymore. What hope? What a bold vision, even gutsy, because frankly, it's borderline ridiculous. I mean, for Isaiah's people, Zion, let's start with the topography of it all. Zion was by far not the tallest mountain around. Jerusalem, was by far not the most distinguished or put together or cosmopolitan of the world's capitals. Nations, of course, nations flocked to Jerusalem all the time, but to extract its resources, to take captive its people. And they brought their swords, they brought their spears, for sure, but to conquer, not to learn from the wisdom of God. Peace was far off for a city that was always seeming to find itself perpetually drowning in violence that was coming to it from all the powers that seemed to swirl around it. But this marvelously hopeful vision for salvation is pronounced right in between pronouncements of judgment. Now, I know even as I say that word, we're kind of allergic to the concept of judgment. But the meaning that it carries in Scripture is that God holds human beings accountable to God's moral standards. And what God holds God's people accountable to in Isaiah, how God raises the bar, is to shalom, to this vision, to this idea of that deep, abiding peace where human life, where all creaturely life flourishes as God intended it. And the people, God says, in this judgment have ruptured that shalom with their murder and their rebellion and their injustice and their greed and corruption. And through the prophet, what God is saying is, you have an opportunity to turn that around, to work toward, to hope for shalom. You see, the hope that God offers, that God sets up, is a hope for a world of peace, and it demands human participation in bringing it about to completion. God will surely save, but not without us. That's the ridiculous part, if you ask me. To accomplish this, God enlists human participation. I prefer the term co-conspirators, in recreating life as it is meant to be. And we talk about hope because hope is, if you think about it, what truly undergirds any chance of real change. You can't change yourself. You can't change the world without it. Whether that's to change some interpersonal situation or try to fix a problem on a global scale, hope is always in that, the horizon of what is possible. Hope is fundamentally an act of imagination. And that's what makes, I think, its alternatives, cynicism and despair, so tempting, because those are the low-hanging fruit of life. It is much easier to grab onto cynicism and despair than it is to cast a vision of hope, to imagine this world of shalom. And so I think with Isaiah's audience, we're tempted to despair. We are tempted these days, oh so tempted, to give in to this cynicism that just covers everything. I mean, the violence that they in Judah knew, we know now. And perhaps maybe we see more of it now because of technology. And the brutality of their everyday life, we know that, maybe in more sophisticated forms. Yet even in the face of the cynicism and despair, in the face of this hopelessness, there are people who, in the face of the impossible, dare to make hope the vision of their horizon. I mean, I'll give you just one example. You probably know your own, but here's just one example. Last year, a group of people in Philadelphia, victims of gun violence, took AR-15s and did exactly what Isaiah described, and they took these semi-automatic weapons and they melted them into gardening tools. And the Sojourners showed this video, and this woman who was the mother of a victim of gun violence, through her megaphone, she told the crowd how long it took her to purchase one of these AR-15s. Can you guess? From the time of application to the time she walked out of the store, 4.5 minutes. 4.5 minutes. And it took 2,000 degrees in a smelter to forge these weapons into pruning hooks. And one of the activists, whose name is Shane Claiborne, he looked at the camera in this video, and he said that that vision of Isaiah, and I'll quote him, is also the inspiration for us repurposing and transforming guns into garden tools. And that vision is really beautiful because it ends with nation will not rise up against nation and will study violence no more. And it begins with the people who refuse to kill and begin to transform tools of death into tools of life. He said, we're not just changing metal today. What we're doing is reimagining the world. And when we beat on this gun, it does really feel like we are participating in changing our streets, our country, our world. An uphill battle if there ever was one. Turning AR-15s into garden spades. I think it's, for all of us, worth pondering this Advent. What changes can we make in our lives that create the conditions for hope to emerge? I mean, you might not own an AR-15, but there probably is something in your ordinary life that is more often than not used as a tool of death and not of life, a tool of violence and not of peace. So what can we do to change? What can God change within us that creates this sense of an urgent hope? For we can't say passively or intentionally that we hope for a world of XYZ without it requiring something of us. And thanks be to God that God is always giving us grace and giving us a glimpse of that new creation of that world of shalom in the person of Jesus Christ to be able to make these small steps in hope toward this world of shalom. If we hope for a planet that does not burn, there's something that has to change. If we hope for communities that aren't plagued with rancor and tension, something has to change. If we hope for reconciliation in our families, in our congregation, in our friend circles, we have to take steps to change. There's a line from a Billie Holiday song, "The difficult I'll do right now. The impossible will take a little while. The difficult I'll do right now. The impossible will take a little while." What, by God's grace, can we do that is difficult? How can we beat a gun into a pruning hook? What do we hope for? Not hope, but hope. What do we yearn for that inspires us to work with God for the impossible shalom that begins right now? I'll close with a blessing called The Blessing of Hope by Jan Richardson. I invite you to close your eyes and pray with me this blessing. So may we know the hope that is not just for someday, but for this day. Here, now, in this moment that opens to us. Hope not made of wishes, but of substance. Hope made of sinew and muscle and bone. Hope that has breath and a beating heart. Hope that will not keep quiet and be polite. Hope that knows how to holler when it is called for. Hope that knows how to sing when there seems little cause. Hope that raises us from the dead, not someday, but this day, every day, again and again and again. May it be so. In response to the word, I invite you to stand and sing the first verse of the hymn that is in your bulletin insert, What Can't Wait.